presents First Years, a podcast for all but geared toward adult first-time readers of Harry Potter, who need a space to enjoy each book and have adult conversations about it. My name is Sarah, and I'm honored that you've allowed me on this journey with you. Crack open a butterbeer, grab a seat, and let's discuss. Welcome, everybody, to episode 50 of First Years. And here to celebrate episode 50 with me, Danny and Stephen from Creating Magic are back with me.
Congratulations on 50 episodes.
Thank you.
More importantly than that, I'm making this about me. I feel pretty important that we're included in the 50th year. I'll tell you what, I feel more important coming here than Danny makes me feel on our own podcast.
That's not nice.
No one said I had to be nice. I just had to come prepared with chapters 8 and 9 of Order of the Phoenix, and that's what I did.
Very true.
And that is what we're going to talk about today. Chapters 8 and 9, and they're pretty big chapters. I think we get a lot of insight into the wizarding world in these two chapters. The biggest part really is, you know, Harry's hearing in these chapters. And he has the hearing in the courtroom that we saw in the Pensieve in the previous book, where very bad wizards were getting sent to Azkaban. The Minister of Magic is interrogating and sort of running the hearing. They changed the time and didn't notify Harry or Dumbledore about it. And Harry's being tried in front of the full court and not just a section of it, like normal. What are your guys' initial thoughts on that?
Well, it's funny. I think it's actually emblematic of what this two-chapter span kind of read for me as, which is these chapters feel like they're all about unmet expectations, right? So whether it's Harry walking in realizing, oh, I didn't realize I've been here before, be it in a memory, the full ministry interrogation, right? As we go through the hearing, right? Dumbledore showing up, Dumbledore not looking at Harry, Fudge being put off kilter by the fact that Dumbledore is there, Harry being like, I didn't really get to explain my case at all. That wasn't what I expected. Like, the whole hearing is a bunch of, from different perspectives, unmet expectations. And as we go through the rest of these chapters, I think there's a lot of other instances where things aren't happening the way that Harry or other characters thought they would. And I think that's the driving force that I picked up on. I do have to say, before Danny gives her answer, the first time we were on your podcast, I did not read the assigned reading at all. Didn't even pretend to glance at it. The second time I read the cliff notes for the chapters, and for this, I actually read the actual pages in the book from start to finish. So it's just like an ascendancy here.
I'm honored.
Anywho, Danny, what did you think about the hearing and the setup?
It took them 3 tries to understand the assignment. I feel like there's a lot of tantrum throwing going on in this chapter. How things are handled. He sounds like a child being like, well, what about this time? Even though we've already let him off and we didn't charge him anything. But what about this? Like, it's just very, he wants his way. And when it doesn't go his way, it just feels like trying to find any semblance to make it so that Harry is suspended and his wand is revoked.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Fudge definitely has an agenda here, even from before the hearing. Like, I mean, we find out, you know, in this hearing that Fudge already wasn't sort of following the rules as far as like what the procedures are if someone gets in trouble, right? But even before we actually knew that, like, no, it's written in the rules that you can't confiscate the wand right away. And 2, like, you don't have the power to expel students from Hogwarts. It still felt like wrong when Harry first got the letters from the ministry. Like, wait, why are they taking his wand now? Like, that doesn't seem right. That, you know, you would think first you would have the hearing, and then if he gets expelled, then you take the wand, not beforehand.
Well, like, and like, yes, he performed magic underage, and yes, there was cost, but it's not like he like went around like cursing somebody. It's not like it was a spell where there was like actual harm done.
Yeah, what I found interesting here is from the start, you're right, from the confiscation of the wand letter and that whole thing, just the different system of very heavily air quoted justice that the Wizarding World has, which ties into a whole other diatribe I can go on yet again here about the role of the Ministry of Magic and the government in Wizarding society.
If there but was like, ever a time to go on that rant, the 50th episode is it.
Well, it's just like, I've sat on a jury trial before here in the States, and the second any lawyer said any sort of sentence that was remotely prejudicial or based on hearsay or had any sort of real emotion to it, the other side is like, hey, no, can't do that, objection, right? Corny Fudge is just, like, he's creating a whole story. When the Dementor conversation comes up, he goes, I thought we'd heard this, wouldn't you? And he, like, creates, like, the whole pretext. It was wild. It was absolutely wild to read the hearing. And like, you're reading it through the lens of what's Harry, 14, 15 here. So like, fair enough. What does he know? They don't have court procedurals in the Wizarding World for him to watch. But like, even for the average layperson, like, this is not how this is supposed to go, man.
No, not at all. And that's like, that's totally what jumped out at me when I was reading it too. I was like, oh my God, wait a second. The Minister of Magic is able to A, interrogate Harry and also like sentence him if they were gonna like convict him, I guess, for this charge. My initial thoughts were that it totally seems like a massive conflict of interest, and it seems like government shouldn't work this way. It also makes things a lot scarier because it's so formal. And the only time we've seen this room before is people getting sent to Azkaban. And, you know, Harry, yes, is 15. And, you know, he literally just survived a Dementor attack. And now it's like this room is associated with getting sent to Azkaban. And where there are more Dementors inevitably, right? And it also felt like a punch in the gut to see Percy Weasley here, and he just doesn't care what's going on at all and seems eager to play his part in this against someone that he has known since Harry was like 11. And when we look at the interrogators that are here, like I said, it's Fudge, the Minister of Magic, Amelia Bones, who at least is the head of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement, Umbridge, who is senior undersecretary to the minister, and Percy's the court scribe, and he's also junior assistant to the minister or whatever his title is. Like, there's only one person out of that group who I feel like deserves to be here as the interrogator.
The Percy thing is interesting. I'm glad you brought that up, because I don't want to dig too deep into the movies, because I know you'll have a wonderful episode about that at the conclusion of Order of the Phoenix, but they choose to reframe the entire hearing as like this battle of rising tension and emotion between Harry and Fudge and eventually the toad-faced witch in the back, right? Like, Percy is not really part of that, but when you know, reading these chapters, it's Percy nodding his head, I think, I forget the word, pompously or indignantly or whatever word they use, that causes Harry to finally speak up after Fudge had been steamrolling him. And I thought it was just very interesting. It was something that it felt true to form, right? I think it's probably fair for a teenager to be a little bit awed at these seemingly important wizards high up on a dais, but for his blood to really rise at his friend's older brother, right, being up there, like, that would tick me off too. That would get me going. I thought that was a really nice, sad, but nice kind of trigger for Harry there.
It's also a bit wild that Harry, being an underage wizard, is not allowed to have any form of guardian with him.
Right?
Like, it would have made sense for Arthur to be allowed to enter the room with him. Like, and I know, like, Dumbledore ends up there, but the plan was for, like, Dumbledore to miss the owl and not show up. So 15-year-old Harry was meant to be there by himself with no one to support him.
Yeah. Yeah, Harry, like, absolutely doesn't get, like, a free lawyer and, like, would have been screwed if Dumbledore hadn't shown up. And barely gets a chance to present his own evidence. And even when he tries to, Fudge just, like, dismisses it and tries to cut him off and, you know, just wants to rush this through. Like, he doesn't actually, I think it's very evident, he doesn't care about the actual justice of the situation, right? He just, like, wants to, you know, punish Harry. And, you know, and it's not just the fact that, like, he was breaking rules, you know, on the night that Harry produced the Patronus, but he also talks about how, well, laws can be changed. And he's making it seem like he could just change these laws, like, right now. You know, like, what do we think is the process of creating law in the wizarding world if you could just, like, change it in a courtroom?
The whole thing is really screwy. What I really found fascinating about the whole process of laws and magic is presented throughout the series so far. We don't really understand where magic necessarily comes from, I don't think. Like, in other fantasy stories, whenever there's a fantastical element, there tends to be, like, a fairly concrete explanation for where that magic stems from. We don't really get that explicitly throughout Potter. It's people are born with magic or they aren't, and there's different ways, whether it be a squib like Mrs. Fig or, you know. But what I found to be interesting was when Dumbledore is talking about how laws are changed and all of that, he's very logical, which is just in a series where there isn't necessarily a logic applied to the core concept, right? Dumbledore is saying, if we agree that there were Dementors there and we agree that the Ministry controls the Dementors, therefore, like, I read that passage and it made my hairs on my arm stand up, certainly not on my head because I lack those, but that stood out to me, that paragraph.
Yeah, same here. And I think, you know, it's interesting that, you know, I feel like with Dumbledore sort of coming in to save the day again, you know, this is like Dumbledore going to bat for Harry against Fudge, like, not once, but twice. And he's the one who's reminding Fudge about, you know, his own laws that are already in place. And I'm glad you brought up, you know, the logic he uses as far as, like, why the Dementors were there, because Fudge just, like, can't give a straight answer and is just blatantly rejecting Dumbledore's logic, even though, like, it has to be one or the other. Like, either Voldemort's back and he's controlling the Dementors, like Dumbledore warned Fudge that he would at the end of last book, or the Ministry still has its shit together and somebody in the Ministry sent the Dementors after Harry. Which one do you guys think it is?
Danny, I don't know what you think, but the Ministry up until this point has given me no reason to believe that they are competent. So, yeah, the Ministry has given me no reason to believe they're competent. So if you're telling me that there's someone out there who's doing something nefarious from within the Ministry, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Like, they don't have their house in order.
Yeah, they're not paying attention enough to be like, oh, hey, someone managed to get to Azkaban and communicate. How do you even communicate with a Dementor? Like,
another great question. Like, how do Dementors get orders?
Who's the person that, like, goes up to a Dementor and be like, hey, I have a job for you. I can't offer you money because you don't really care about money because you live on this island.
Like, I wonder if it's like some poor intern. I have so many questions. I don't know. I mean, but it definitely has to be one or the other. And I feel like either way, it's not great. It's not a great situation for, you know, not just Harry, but for the wizarding world to be in general, if the Ministry is either losing control of the Dementors or the Ministry is sending Dementors to attack you know, a teenage kid. One of the other things, one of the other pieces that's really important here is at least when Harry gets to sort of talk about, you know, the circumstances of what actually happened, and he's not like, yeah, I was just doing magic for the hell of it. Like, no, I was actually saving my life and my cousin's life from these Dementors. I had two thoughts. One, why do you guys think they don't use a pensieve at hearings like this? And second of all, Mrs. Fig comes in to give her testimony. Do you think she's lying, or do you think Squibs can actually see Dementors? And if she is lying, why does the Ministry not automatically know what Squibs can and cannot see in this world?
Well, for that they don't know, I think that for the most part, the Wizarding World has written off any Squib and doesn't bother to learn or even care on why Squibs are essentially created without magic, like how that happens. I feel like there are no scientists that want to study this subject in the Wizarding World.
You could buy that for sure.
What was the first question? I forgot.
The first question is, why don't they use a pensieve?
Oh, so I'm not going to say what, because we haven't gotten there yet. There is another implement that shows up some point in the future of these books that I'm not going to mention where or when, that is largely regarded as the ultimate get out of jail free card, that had to be explained by the author as for its disappearance after its initial appearance. That's all I'm going to say. That was broad and convoluted because I'm not getting in trouble here. What I will say is the pensieve is number two on that list. It's forgot about because people love to talk about number one, which we'll get to on this podcast eventually, people. But yeah, you're right. The pensieve is the ultimate plot hole because, yeah, I suppose you could make an argument that memories can be altered or something, but highly trained wizards probably have the ability to determine if something's been altered. So yeah, that one doesn't add up.
But wouldn't using a pensieve be like a very big invasion of privacy?
We're talking
about... I feel like ethically...
Yeah, because the ministry cares about ethics. Well, yeah.
Yeah, but...
But even if, like, it... Even if they had to get permission first, like, I would think Harry would be like,
yeah Harry would be like, yes, please clear my name.
And even if, like, there is the argument that, like, memories can't really be trusted because, like, they're, you know, inherently biased to the person who has them, then doesn't that just defeat the purpose of a pensieve? Like, isn't the whole point to, like, store your memories so you can, like, look them back over? So wouldn't you sort of want them to be preserved as they happened?
But the whole thing about memory being biased, that's human nature. What if I tell you a story, or if you go into my head and see it, you're either way receiving
the same story,
the message through the lens of my experience, right? Which is why I found really a nice touch at the end of Mrs. Fig's testimony when Fudge says, or Madam Bones, one of the two, that is what you saw? And she goes, no, that is what happened, mm-hmm. Right? Which is, that's the whole question. Is it perception bias, or is it reality? Can perception bias ultimately be reality? I thought that was really well written.
So do you guys think she's lying, or do you think, like, she actually can see the Dementors?
It was dusk in an alleyway and an old lady with a lot of cats. I'm not saying she didn't see anything, but I'm also not saying that she's...
Are you saying that crazy cat ladies aren't good witnesses?
She's not the most ideal of... I'm not saying crazy cat ladies don't make good witnesses, but her explanation of things and, like, describing Harry and Dudley, it makes you question if this was a good choice.
Well, but that said, I mean, look, she's not the ultimate character witness. Sure, fair enough. But it was, you know, Harry's perception of that whole questioning there between Mrs. Fig and then watching Madam Bones. When Mrs. Fig first describes them as large wearing cloaks, right, the text says to us, Harry supposed she could have read that anywhere. And Mrs. Bones kind of looked at her kind of coolly and disapprovingly. And then when she describes going cold and all that, Harry said, you know, it says like Harry noticed Madam Bones' eyes kind of widen, you know, suddenly. And so it answers that question, right? Whether you think she could see them or not, you can see the moment twist where it goes from, oh, like she could have figured this out anywhere in a magazine to, oh, well, no, that, you know, that tracks.
I don't deny that she didn't sense them, but physically actually seeing, I question.
Yeah, no, and that's interesting, especially if she can sense them, especially since I feel like the Dementors are like always described as this sort of like overwhelming feeling that like affects everything around them. Like it's a warm summer's night and then all of a sudden like the sky's gone and it's freezing, right? There's one more thing I want to ask about Mrs. Fig. How did she end up as part of Order of the Phoenix the first time around?
In my head, I feel like there's some like connection to the Potters, but don't quote me on that. But I feel like there was like a connection where she knew somebody or someone, and we also don't know her history. So like she comes from a magical family.
Right. I just think it's so interesting that it's like, if, you know, she's a squib who like is sort of on the outside of the wizarding world, right? Like the only other squib that we know of is Filch, and he's still like, you know, he's at Hogwarts, but like, he can't really participate in the world at all. And she ends up not just like involved in like a group of wizards, but like in a secret group of wizards that like works for Dumbledore against like the big wizarding bad guy. Not just once, but twice.
I'm researching.
It looked like you were Googling something.
I'm not doing that.
It doesn't seem to be a definitive answer.
We're just left to wonder.
Yeah, the only thing I see, which is nowhere mentioned in any of the books or the movies, so I don't know where this information came from. Oh, it says married, divorced, or widowed. So I'm like, maybe she was married to a magical person at some point.
Maybe. I mean, yeah, that's entirely possible.
Because she still has her foot, like, in the magical world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm more willing to buy that she was probably like involved with someone who's a wizard who might have been part of the order the first time around and maybe didn't make it.
Yeah. I feel like that would track. That's going to be my headcanon for now until I find out more.
Okay, so yes, Dumbledore comes in and, you know, saves Harry's ass at this hearing. But Harry's noticing that Dumbledore really isn't looking at him. And Dumbledore also doesn't even tell Arthur Weasley about the verdict of the trial when he exits the room, which seems really odd to me.
Again, another moment where expectations are unmet. That one's a pretty basic one, but it's still unmet. Harry doesn't understand why Dumbledore serenely strolls into the courtroom and doesn't look at him, and then afterwards rushes right out. Arthur doesn't say he didn't understand why, but Arthur's like, hey, Dumbledore didn't tell me what happened. He walked right by me, right? Like, bizarre behavior from a already bizarre man.
Yeah, it's just weird that he wouldn't. Like, it's one thing, like, not talking to Harry, like, not great, not a good look, but then ignoring the adult that's the guardian who Dumbledore has entrusted to keep an eye out and watch over Harry and not informing him what happened.
Well, weird. Yeah, it seems like a really weird move. Like, even if you're kind of, for some reason, distancing yourself from Harry, to then just not even tell Arthur, like, or give any indication as to, like, how the hearing went. Like, I'd be really interested to know what Dumbledore's motivation for that was, of like, oh, we're going to have Harry tell Mr. Weasley, I'm not going to tell him. It seems like an odd choice.
Speaking of odd choices, it wouldn't be a podcast with me if I didn't bring up a World War II allegory from Harry Potter. Is Cornelius Fudge the Neville Chamberlain of the Wizarding World? Because I ask this because we see in the scene right after that Fudge is very chummy with Lucius Malfoy, who Harry's inner monologue is quick to remind us is a Death Eater who was seen groveling in front of Voldemort not 6 months prior or whatever. For those who are unaware, I will do my best impression of Sarah Jones Dittmeyer doing a historical deep dive. Neville Chamberlain was the Prime Minister of Great Britain during the pre-World War II 1930s. He met with Adolf Hitler being the leader of the Nazi Party in Germany, for those who are unaware. The term appeasement came out of his geopolitical philosophy for Hitler, essentially meaning that Chamberlain was comfortable letting Nazi Germany continue in its pre-war buildup, such as it was in a way. Neville Chamberlain, while there are many reasons why, of course, the Nazi Party in Germany rose to infamous preeminence in the late 30s and early 40s, Neville Chamberlain is not the sole cause of that, but certainly he is credited in history with being one of the reasons why World War II occurred. We don't know what happens with Cornelius Fudge and the wizarding government moving past chapters 8 and 9 yet, but he's getting chummy in dark corners and then going up to his office with Lucius Malfoy. Can't be good, right?
Yeah, not at all. And I thought it was just like the greatest moment of irony to have Fudge be so adamant that Voldemort is not back, and then to be conversing with Lucius Malfoy, who, like you said, Harry says was in like full Death Eater wardrobe just a few weeks prior. You know, so he's being fooled by these people that like obviously don't want him to know that Voldemort is back. And I wonder, do we think then, is Fudge just in denial about Voldemort, or is there a worse ulterior motive from him? But also I think this speaks to the role that rich families play in the wizarding world when it comes to government, because it specifically says that Lucius Malfoy gives money so he can stop certain laws from being passed.
I feel like Fudge is just clueless, because like, also, why are we not questioning, like, okay, we get it, Malfoy has money, Malfoy has power, but he's down in the level where the big court cases take place, where Arthur Weasley wasn't allowed past a certain point, where he has nothing to do with it, doesn't work for the ministry. Why are we not questioning the floor that he is on? Like, that's, it's not really like he was, they bumped into him in the lobby. They were like outside the courtroom doors.
Yeah, I think the money thing explains all of the answer. I mean, Fudge, as we have seen in this chapter alone, never mind what we've seen from Fudge in the past, is just realpolitik 101. He just wants to maintain power, and he'll do whatever he can, good, bad, or otherwise, to maintain that power, right? Whether it's sending Hagrid off to Azkaban because it sends the bad message to not, right? Whether it's waving away Harry blowing up his aunt and, you know, being completely cool with that, whether it's having a full-blown trial and completely abandoning all seeming sense of logic for underage magic, right? To the hero of the wizarding world, right? Or whether it's, you know, cozying up to a very wealthy, seemingly generous Death Eater, right? Fudge is gonna do whatever he can to remain on top of the totem pole. So yeah, it's pathetic, but it's pretty easily explainable, I think. How did I do on my deep dive? I know you I didn't bring in Norse mythology or anything, but like I was pretty proud of that.
You did great. I did some research to see, because I was interested to know what the separation of powers looked like in the UK. And I researched a little bit just for context, because obviously reading it through an American lens, having Fudge, you know, on a court is pretty outrageous. But I think you did much better than I was struggling to sort of break down UK government. from before 2005 and after 2005 to figure out what the separation of powers actually looks like.
I am nothing if not your resident Anglophile. Always happy to help.
So, okay. So, yeah, I don't think it's surprising that Fudge is talking to Lucius Malfoy, unfortunately. I think it says a lot about, you know, sort of the culture in Wizarding World, in the Wizarding World in general, especially with the whole pureblood muggle-born dynamic that we see permeate pretty much everything. But after this, you know, result of the hearing, Harry takes all of his money and pours it into the fountain. And I wanted to know what you guys thought of that moment.
I feel so bad for Arthur Weasley, who's sitting. The Weasleys have boarded Harry. They've given him room. They've taken care of him. They've protected him. They are already known to be a family with a lack of abundant means. And there's Harry throwing all of his money, which I have to imagine is more than the Weasleys probably see in like a month. I don't know. Seemed like a lot of money. Just straight into a fountain. And I know it's going to St. Mungo's River to a good cause. But like, Arthur's got to be sitting there like, my guy, I fed you for the past couple weeks. Like, you've stayed at my house a lot. I've got 7 kids and I work a mediocre job. You want to give one of those to me? I felt so bad for Arthur.
I mean, yes, but I also don't think Arthur sees things that way.
I think if you have 7 children and you kind of sort of adopt an 8th, just, you know, because he's the savior of the Wizarding World and he's your 6th kid's best friend, you can't not see things at least a little bit that way. I'm not saying he's like writing up a bill every month and leaving charges under the door. But after a while, I'll be like, my guy, Molly made roast chicken and cheap, you know.
Maybe.
So speaking of the Weasleys, the other big thing that happens in these 2 chapters is that Ron becomes a prefect. And it's kind of, at least at first, it's kind of a tough thing for Harry. This wasn't something that he even was thinking about that he wanted. Like, he totally forgot about it until Ron and Hermione got their letters. And yet other people thought for sure that Harry was going to get it. Do you think that the fact that other people thought Harry was going to get it and then told him so played into the jealousy that he was feeling? Or would he have like felt this jealous anyway?
Well, again, I think it's another expectations thing, because I think Harry subliminally or subconsciously expected to be named prefect, even if it wasn't something that was like top of his vision board. Hermione quite literally says, "Are you sure?" when Harry says, "No, it's Ron," right? Like, it's another instance where expectations are being subverted. And yeah, like you hear Kingsley talking about it later in the next chapter, I think, or at the end of this chapter, I forget, right? I think it's inherent to be jealous. I think Harry suffers from, Harry very clearly does not want to be the main character in the story, right? Harry is very comfortable just being Harry, as he said before, you know? That said, Harry kind of is pampered at Hogwarts, whether he realizes it or not. And being made prefect very much kind of is the thing that like, oh, I wouldn't have raised my hand and said, give me that. But yeah, I probably should have been made prefect. I'm Harry Potter. I thought that was fascinating.
I'm just saying, Ron and Harry are not good choices for prefect. The amount of trouble those two have gotten into and the chaos they cause and the lack of homework they get done, they should not be at the top of this list.
Yeah, but who else is it going to be? Seamus? No, I mean, come on. Neville, who is a lovely man at heart, little by his boy.
Maybe
his point
Dean.
At heart.
We don't know enough. Like,
We don't know enough about Dean. All we know is Dean likes West Ham and Dean is friends with Seamus, and that's about it.
But they're both not in detention as much as
Harry. Well, you don't know that. You don't know that. You just know that we have not seen Dean in detention. That's all.
True. I don't think Ron and Harry are the choices here. And like, if Harry was chosen, that would definitely come out of a place of favoritism over deserving to be.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. It's not like the Weasley kids are like the O'Doyles from Billy Madison, right? Every O'Doyle is you know, big and dumb and oafy in Billy Madison. O'Doyle rules, you know? The Weasleys, like, if Dumbledore is trying to extrapolate, like, that, hey, we're at a crossroads for Ron here, don't get me wrong, Percy has made some bad choices, but Percy is seemingly very intelligent. Bill seems to be a stand-up guy. Charlie has a good job. The Weasley twins, while being very mischievous, are smart, right? So maybe this is Dumbledore's way of trying to push Ron in a direction and hoping that he rises to the challenge rather than kind of cowers in fear and you know, kind of turns away from it. I don't know.
Possibly.
I think that's really interesting to think about, you know, because so sort of like twice, like in this chapter and also in earlier chapters of this book, like Harry sort of reiterates all of the things he's done so far in this series. Right. And the first time, is when he's yelling at Ron and Hermione after he first arrives at Grimmauld Place. And it's more like he's just trying to justify, like, I've done all of these things, so I, you know, deserve the respect to be included in whatever's going on. And you guys can't just like ignore me and not give me information. That's not fair. But here, you know, he kind of reckons with like, do I think I'm better than Ron? And he can't really help himself to, again, think about all of these things that he's done. But Ron and Hermione have definitely helped him to get to where he was. Not to mention that they absolutely would have helped him, you know, with everything. They would have gone as far as like helping him with the stone and like going down into the Chamber of Secrets. But there were literal physical barriers that stopped them from going with him all the way into those specific places. So maybe that feeds into another reason why maybe Ron isn't a good choice either, because, you know, if Harry's thinking, oh yeah, I've caused you much trouble, like Ron would have been right beside you if there wasn't like a partial cave-in, you know, in Chamber of Secrets. But my two questions, you know, sort of going along with that is, what do you think this moment means for Ron? And what does this say about the competition between friends, especially at this age?
Well, again, I think this is like a deciding point for Ron, whether he wanted it or not. And we'll see how it plays out. But again, this is where, does Ron become more rebellious because he loathes being put in a position of accountability, or does Ron rise to it and lead by example, blah 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 blah. What was the second question? I had a really good thought and then it went right out of my head.
What does this say about competition between friends?
This is risky because we just had Goblet of Fire right behind us. Great book, awful movie, where Harry and Ron have a whole big falling out because of perceived bias and competition and, you know, preeminence throughout the castle. So this is like a really fine kind of razor's edge that Dumbledore is putting them right back on after they just got off of it in the last book. So I don't really know. Danny?
There's also this line of, is Ron going to step up into this position, or, which he has done in the past with his homework, rely on Hermione to make all the choices and use the position more for fun and enjoyment on his side? I just think it's a weird choice. I don't think it's a good choice.
I mean, maybe we'll see, like, if Ron, like, which of the brothers Ron will follow. Will he, you know, yes, be a prefect, which Fred and George aren't and weren't, but sort of follow them, or will he? So, I mean, I don't think he'll follow like Percy's example at all.
Yeah, let's skip Percy, but maybe Bill or Charlie.
Yeah, but yeah, maybe will he follow Bill and Charlie, you know, as an example instead?
I have a question on that one. What was up with Molly just forgetting she had Fred and George as children?
that was kind of like a brutal, you know, moment where, you know, she's like, that's everyone. No, it's not. Not even close.
Like, she's fine mentioning Percy's name out loud, despite kind of the estrangement happening there. Forgets her loud, boisterous, obnoxious twins who are like right in front of her face. That was kind of crazy. I don't know if it matters, but it was kind of crazy. Anyhow.
No, definitely. I mean, I don't know. I feel like it's definitely hard to forget about them when they've been like using magic all over the place all summer and just causing trouble.
I feel like the moment was more so in the writing of it was not for Molly to be forgetful, but to have a comedic moment with the twins. I think that's more the aim.
I like that reading.
Classic Fred and George moment versus Molly being daft and forgetting the kids she's been yelling at for apparating everywhere all summer.
Yeah. So they have a party for Ron and Hermione to celebrate their prefectness, I guess we can call it. This is where I feel like we start to understand the seriousness of this situation and where we are in this book and in this series as a whole. You know, things really, really got real last book when Voldemort came back. But now, you know, Moody shows Harry this old photograph of the original Order of the Phoenix. And, you know, we hear all of these awful details of how each of these people was murdered. And then later on, when we see Mrs. Weasley facing the Boggart, you know, her fear is just seeing all of her dead family members. And Mrs. Weasley talks about, oh, I'm just being silly, like, and she's kind of embarrassed. But I don't think she is. Like, these threats are real. Like, at least half of the people in that photograph that Moody showed are dead now.
Well, again, not to sound like a broken record here, but it's all about unmet expectation. Because even before that, Harry says, turns out living at the headquarters of the Order of the Phoenix wasn't that great and glamorous. It was pretty mundane. Right. So like there's that, which kind of brings down the fun and kind of gives space for there to be something other than fun. And then you're hit with the Moody bit, which again, Moody thinks he's doing something cool for Harry here. And Harry's like, oh my God, these guys, everyone's dead here. Like, I don't want to see this. And so that's when you're right, the gravity of everything hits. And then even that chapter ends with Harry saying it was kind of crazy to him that just, you know, half an hour ago he was worried about prefects and parties and now and dung bombs or whatever, right? And now like the weight of the Wizarding World is back on his shoulders. Chapter definitely ends on a bit of a dark note, doesn't it?
I think Molly's response is very parental. Like, she's trying to protect the kids she has around her from, yes, this is a possibility and these are her fears, but she doesn't want them to necessarily know her fears. And she kept seeing, like, don't tell Arthur. Like, she wants to appear to be the strong, powerful person who has it all together and is working to help rather than be swallowed up by her emotions.
I think, you know, looking at that from, you know, Mrs. Weasley being trying to be strong, right? I think really speaks to, you know, her being a mother and, you know, a mother of many kids. And, you know, you definitely do have to take on that role, even if you're, you know, terrified or something, you know, bad happens, you kind of have to be the brave one in that situation. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, just for Mrs. Weasley to be involved in the order sort of speaks to that bravery. And, you know, I think it's important to recognize that, like, you know, you can be brave and also have your moments where you're going to lose it, especially when the stakes are that high.
And also, like, in that house, she is essentially the caregiver. Like, Hermione's also there, Harry's there. All the other adults that are in this situation are very much focused on what is Voldemort doing, where she is focused on the people and making sure they are cared for.
So with sort of the end note of these two chapters, you know, what does this show us you know, about where we are in this series.
Well, Goblet kind of resets the timeline. I've talked about this a lot in various places. I don't even know where at this point, right? And this is not a Stephen Hadler original thought by any means, but, you know, Goblet resets the entire kind of clock of the series, in that before you get to Goblet, you probably are expecting the series to culminate with Harry and Voldemort meeting, right? That just, if you were thinking just kind of semi-logically as a consumer, that makes the most sense. Then all of a sudden at the end of Goblet, the author throws in this battle and the series isn't over. We get another book, right? Like Order of the Phoenix, you know, is there. So, okay, everything is reset now. So now you're operating for this book under a whole new reality and premise of what to expect. And what to expect is you don't know what to expect. So these opening chapters in order are so important because it resets kind of the cadence of how this series is going to go. And if these two chapters tell us anything, it's that darkness is kind of on us, right? Because if you think about these two chapters, you get the hearing, which is super dark. You get Harry's elation right afterwards and how happy he is that he got off. But then you get darkness immediately again, whether it's semi-darkness with the prefect thing, which makes him jealous and petty, or ultimately kind of the reality of the Order of the Phoenix and the upcoming battle. So like I think like, these chapters set up the rest of this book, the rest of this series in a very sobering way.
I could see that. And it's also, we're in, this is book 5 of 7. We are right in the middle. So this is where things start. We've had our basis of introduction of characters. We know where we are in this world. And so this is where like things start to get grittier in a way. And you can even tell from the tone of this book, it is very different from the previous books. Like stuff's about to go down.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely seen like the progression of like, you know, even in just like the first chapter of each book so far, like things are a little different. Harry's a little different. You know, he obviously changes basis on like what he experienced in the previous book, right? And I think, you know, Harry probably went through the biggest change in book 4, especially because, you know, I mean, the Triwizard Tournament's scary enough on your own. And then to have it culminate in this like very traumatic, dark moment where Harry, you know, it sees like his number one enemy come back after murdering one of his classmates. And then Harry has to like bring Cedric back. And that in itself has to be very hard to go through. And we see that, you know, in the beginning of this book. And I feel like we're sort of, you know, like you said, Danny, like we're on book 5 of 7. And so we're kind of like at the midway point, but at sort of like the midway point where things are about to shift to bring us toward the second half of this series. And, you know, it's not just about, you know, wizards and magic anymore. It's about, you know, what can people who don't have good intentions do with that magic? And, you know, what can people who are using magic for good do with their magic, you know, and sort of what, how do you prep on either side, I guess, you know, because neither side has really made their move yet. You know, we're kind of at that like tension point. You know, it's almost like, pardon me for bringing a Lord of the Rings reference in, it's like the moment right before the Battle of Helm's Deep starts, where they kind of just stand off for a little bit before someone, you know, accidentally or otherwise shoots that first arrow.
Let's see how well Danny knows me. Danny, what two songs am I dying to sing right now?
I'm not sure because I got stuck in Lord of the Rings.
God, that's disappointing.
Usually I do really well, but so, I got so excited when I heard Lord of the Rings.
Sarah, at the beginning of that soliloquy, you used the phrase "on your own," which got me thinking about how Harry must have felt after Dumbledore left him after the hearing, which is "on my own, pretending he's beside me, all alone." And anywho, and then the second thing you said was something about magic for good, using magic for good. And of course, that got me thinking that it well may be that we will never meet again in this lifetime. So let me say before we part so much of me. Anywho, I have no way to twist out of those, but that's what I got, guys.
What are we gonna do with you?
Look, I've sang on this podcast before. This is not new. So I don't really remember. Again, I black out when we record episodes for any podcasts. Like, I don't really remember what I sang, but I do have some vague memory in the back of my bald cranium of singing during a prior episode. So listeners, this is like a very poorly sang, warm welcome back into the embrace of Muggle and Khakis on a podcast. You're welcome.
Yeah, I think that's all of my notes. Unless you guys have anything else that stood out to you in these two chapters.
I really enjoyed during the party scene, just the little one shots we get of all the different characters and how spot on they are. When Moody is Moody's a great one. When he's congratulating Ron, he's like, well, you attract more attention for danger this way, but hopefully, you know, and Ron's like startled by it. Or like, you, like all of a sudden after a couple more paragraphs, like Moody sniffed a chicken and after realizing there was no poison, he must have felt fine. So he dug like great stuff like that.
And the reason she wasn't a prefect.
Right. Like you get just these little tiny little snippets of conversation or observation and it's just one or two sentences and they are just spot on. Like if you were to define a character by a couple sentences, each of those little drive-bys you get are perfect. I thought those were great.
I don't think I have anything.
I'll tell you what, this podcast is a lot more fun when I read the pages ahead of time.
See what happens when you prep?
It's always fun, don't get me wrong, but it's a lot more fun when I know what the heck's going on. So we should do this more often.
Anytime.
Two more books after this one.
Yeah. And it only gets more fun from here. thank you guys so much for joining me yet again. I love having you guys on.
We enjoy coming on to your podcast and we can't wait to have you back on ours.
Yay. I don't know.
I can see him preparing something.
I was going to sing again, but I'm not. It's fine. Thanks for having us, Sarah. It's always a pleasure talking with you and getting to chat a bit to your listeners.
First Years is a production of Matchbook. It's produced by Quinn Parker and myself, Sarah Jones-Dittmeyer. All sources can be found in our show notes or on our website at authorsarahjonesdittmeyer.info/firstyearspodcast. That's Sarah with an H, and Dittmeyer is spelled Dittmeier. Please remember that staying a Harry Potter fan is the biggest form of revolt that you can have, and we are committed to continuing to make this fandom and this community safe and welcoming to everybody.